Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, a Nerd Manual. We are here to discuss new nerd creations, how they were made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today we're talking about Arrival. It's the brand new science fiction film directed by Denis Villeneuve, is that right?
That sounds good.
Ish.
Yeah, I
feel like I'd be
butchering
French names.
Sounds very French-Canadian to me.
Yes, that's accurate. It was released on November 11th, 2016. The screenplay was by Eric Heiser, and it's based on the short story, Story of Your Life, by Ted Chiang. This movie stars Amy Adams, Jeremy Renner, and Forrest Whitaker, amongst others. They're not the only three people in this movie, but they're the
main characters.
The most mentionable. And Arrival follows the story of Luis Banks, a linguist who is recruited by the U.S. government to try to communicate with aliens that have just landed on Earth. I'm going to be talking about the history of quote-unquote alien encounters, because there is, you know, if you look at the words, technically, there have been alien encounters.
That was with air quotes, technically.
Air quotes, yes. And translation, and what translation can kind of do for these alien encounters. And Claire will be discussing the nuts and bolts side of adapting this story to film. Right, mm-hmm. Claire?
Yes.
Sweet. So let me get started with a brief history of alien encounters and translation. So I want to set the stage for all you listeners out there for one of the most well-known quote-unquote alien encounters that ever took place in history. And it's actually, it's not the meeting between space aliens and humans. Like, you can discuss alien astronaut theory all you want. But it's actually the meeting between Montezuma, the emperor of the Aztecs, and the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortez.
Yeah, I guess alien.
They're very, very alien cultures. And it occurred on November 8th in 1519. So Montezuma was probably the most powerful person in Central America at the time. He had an army that was numbered in the hundreds of thousands and a capital city that was larger than any city in Europe at that time.
I know him from Civ 5, and he seems very powerful in Civ 5.
Yeah, he's a big jerk in Civ 5. He's always invading and trying to sacrifice
people. I
know,
and he has fire all around him when he talks to you.
Yeah,
Civ 5
yeah.
is a video game, for yeah. those who don't yeah. know.
So his capital, Tenochtitlan, was the largest city that any of those Spanish conquistadors had ever seen. It was this sprawling metropolis. And I feel like we've all heard the story, maybe it's just me, but the story about how Hernan Cortez, you know, met the Aztecs and they thought the Spanish were gods, quote unquote, and Cortez went on to conquer the whole Aztec Empire with merely 500 Spaniards using their superior weaponry.
And a lot of malaria?
Smallpox was the big thing. Smallpox. And that's certain that, like, there is some truth to that, but that is very far from the entire story. Cortez, in fact, led a rebellion against the Aztecs using a lot more than his 500 Spaniards, and he had actually collected a bunch of Amerindian allies that were rebelling against Aztec rule or that were not happy to be under Aztec rule. So he didn't just have these 500 Spaniards. He had thousands of Native American troops that were with him. And the question I wanted to know was, how did he manage to ally himself with all these people whose language was so vastly different than Spanish? And in fact, how did he even talk at all with Montezuma, the Aztec emperor? And the answer is that he had two very useful translators that he kind of lucked into.
Were they Spanish translators or were they Native American translators?
One was Spanish and one was Native American. So the first translator I'm going to talk about is a guy named Geronimo de Aguilar. And when Cortez first landed in Mexico, he was lucky enough to kind of stumble into a Spanish priest. He had heard tales that there was a Spanish priest enslaved by these Mayans. And he was like, all right, I should try and find this
Whoa,
guy.
How did that Spanish priest get over there?
The Spanish priest was shipwrecked in Mexico off the Yucatan Peninsula in 1511. And he was taken by the Mayans as a slave. And he lived for 8 years with the Mayans and had learned their language over those 8 years. So Cortez found out about this guy, went out to find him because he needed a translator, and he found him. He bought Aguilar's freedom with glass beads from the Mayans.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's crazy. And he was like Cortez's tool for communicating with the Mayans.
Do you know if this guy hated the Mayans?
I'm unsure. He was shipwrecked with another Spanish guy whose name I forget, but that Spanish sailor who was shipwrecked with ended up marrying a Mayan girl and becoming like a Mayan general. So one went like, you know, fully into it and loved the culture and had like a family. But the priest, you know, he's Christian and he was just happy to be back with Spaniards.
Good,
you know,
Catholics.
Good Catholics, yeah, after his 8 years of slavery. And he could speak Mayan, which is a big boon to Cortez. Now the Mayans spoke a much different language, though, even than the Aztecs. But lucky for Cortez, he had once again stumbled into a genius linguist in the form of a woman named Doña Marina, or Malintzin is her native name.
Native name, okay.
Yeah.
Doña
yeah.
Maria, that's, he stumbled into her yeah. because she was Spanish.
She sounds Spanish. So Doña Marina was a Mayan slave who was given to Cortez after he defeated a small Mayan force as reparations. Like, Cortez beat the small Mayan city-state army and demanded all these gold and jewels, and he demanded girls. Mm. So 20 women.
As you do.
As you do, yeah. I mean, the Spanish were not good people. The Aztecs weren't either, but there was a lot of gross stuff in the Spanish conquest of Mesoamerica. It was,
I've heard.
Yeah, yeah. So Doña Marina was originally of Aztec heritage, and she spoke the Aztec language Nahuatl. She also spoke the Mayan language of, there's a bunch of different Mayan dialects.
Oh, because she was a slave.
Because she was a slave with the Mayans. So apparently when Cortez first met the Aztecs, because that's what he was driving towards in central Mexico. He'd heard of these Aztecs and their big cities and their boundless wealth, and he wanted to get there and get those guys.
Get that gold.
Yeah, get that gold. And the Mayans weren't quite as powerful as the Aztecs at this time. So he's driving towards the Aztecs, and he finally meets his first contingent of Aztecs. And Aguilar, his normal translator, is useless. And he, like, doesn't understand why, and he's getting frustrated.
Wait, Cortez doesn't understand why?
Cortez doesn't understand why. He's like, don't all these people speak the same language?
Yeah,
you know,
just like Europe.
Just like, yeah, come on, you ass, just like Europe. Doña Marina sees this, you know, because she's like with the retinue, and she sees what's going on, and she just steps in and starts translating for Cortez. Now, what they started doing was that since Doña Marina could speak Mayan and Nahuatl, the Aztec language, she would translate the Aztec's words to Mayan, mm-hmm. and then Aguilar would translate that Mayan
into Spanish.
So obviously there's a lot that can be lost in translation here with the languages, you know, being switched like in and out, you know, and mm-hmm. all these different dialects. Fortunately for Cortez, Doña Marina learned Spanish with fluency within about a year.
What a boss.
Yeah, she was a genius. And, you know, a native woman all of a sudden took the job of a Spanish man as chief translator and advisor to Cortez in his conquest of the Aztecs and the Mayans.
I had never heard of her. I never knew how important she was, or a woman was in all of this.
Yeah, I had heard about her, but I didn't remember her name. Like, I'd heard that there was just this genius Spanish woman who was able to translate for Cortez. Not that much about her. But essentially, she was with Cortez for his entire conquest of
her people.
Of her own people. And she was pivotal in him getting these other Indian allies to fight back against the Aztecs, because otherwise...
Did she not like the Aztecs? Is that something that's known, or...?
Well, she did convert to Christianity, so she was, like, you know, feeling a little, you know, that kind of religious superiority, and she even...
Religious fervor.
Yeah. She was really pushing the boundaries of gender norms at that time. At that time, women in Aztec culture, they weren't supposed to speak publicly, and no one was allowed to look at the Emperor Montezuma when talking to him. But because she was the translator, she got to do all this.
Wow.
And it was kind of pushing barriers. And she's the reason that Cortez could get these alliances with other tribes that didn't like the Aztecs. And I wonder, you know, if Cortez just had 500 Spaniards, even with guns and smallpox, I don't think there's any way they win that fight against a nation. Even with smallpox.
Wow.
That's not enough people.
I had no idea. I had no idea that he had a whole Aztec army with him.
Yeah, yeah. And she's described by Bernal Diaz del Castillo, who was one of the few conquistadors with Cortez who wrote a lot about her, as this beautiful, fierce, and extremely intelligent woman. And like you said before, you know, she kind of turned her own people over to the Spanish in a lot of ways. She's somewhat polarizing and has an image that's constantly kind of going back and forth throughout history as, like, is she good or is she bad? You know, she's sometimes been seen as this Judas figure that, you know, she betrays her native heritage to help the Spanish. But she's also been seen as this role model for women who was sold into slavery at a young age, but clawed her way kind of to the top of the pecking order.
I think you got to do what you got to do.
Got to do what you got to do. I feel the same way. She's often seen as the mother of modern Mexico because she gave birth to a son with Cortez. She became Cortez's mistress.
Okay.
And this son became was Cortez's like favorite son. And he was also kind of the first high profile, not kind of, he was the first high profile mixed race child. So they kind of see that as, you know, kind of the founding of modern Mexico, where these Spanish...
Because a lot of the conquistadors married Aztec nobles.
Or sometimes they didn't even marry him. Sometimes they just...
Went for it.
Had a good time. and one last thing, she even has a Mexican word named after her, or that's derived from her name, rather. The word is Malinchista, and it's a term used to describe Mexicans who have a preference for foreign things or speak gushy of other countries. So it's not
That's not very nice.
That's not quite a flattering legacy.
No.
But I thought she was especially important because this is one of the biggest alien encounters to ever occur in history. And the main character in Arrival is this genius woman linguist.
Yeah, I'm not seeing all the parallels of their lives. Like, I don't think she married an alien and conquered the world.
Yeah, not in Arrival. No, but there is something to be said there is. About the importance of language, especially when two foreign cultures are meeting. Because without that linguist, who knows? Maybe Cortez's conquest wouldn't have gone quite as well.
Yeah, that's an intense thing.
There's another brief thing, and I say brief. I'm going to try and do this briefly. topic I want to sum up because I think it's really important to this movie. It's a linguistic hypothesis. It's called the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis. And I think you really need to understand this hypothesis to get the most out of Arrival. I think it's a lot more enjoyable when you know what the Sapir-Whorf is.
So if you've already seen the movie, I'm sorry.
Yeah, if you've already seen it, you're too late. It would have been better if you listened to us first.
And know that.
Yes. So in the 1940s, Benjamin Whorf and Edward Sapir hypothesized that the structure of a language influences how we perceive and experience the world. And that learning different languages can, like, in a way, rewire, quote-unquote, your brain. And this theory was, or it's not theory, it's hypothesis, excuse me, was very controversial at the time, and people thought it was, like, a load of BS, a lot of linguists.
How do people think about it now?
It's starting to become a little bit more defensible and evident. And there's a professor Lyra Boroditsky, and she's a professor of cognitive science at University of California, San Diego, and she tells a great example of this hypothesis and why it might be true. I also want to mention that Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is also referred to as linguistic relativity. So Boroditsky, using the study of Aboriginal language, has a really good example of Sapir-Whorf. So you and I, Claire, we approach spatial direction with a body-centric view. I would ask you, you know, pass the cup by your left arm, or I left my keys on the desk to the right, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, in some Aboriginal languages, you don't learn your left or your right. Your spatial direction is based on cardinal direction, so north, south, east, or west. They wouldn't say, pass me the cup by your left arm. They would say, pass me the cup by your southwest-facing arm.
Oh.
Yeah, or I left my keys on the northeast desk. And because of this, because that's so, you learn that so early, like spatial direction is something you learn as a kid. Because of that, because it's ingrained in their language, they have excellent orientation and dead reckoning skills. They can be anywhere and kind of know which direction north, south, east, or west is.
A, that is really cool. B, that fits in so perfectly with Arrival.
Yeah.
And how that could happen. How this language could affect you this way.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a really important part of the movie, and they don't really flesh it out at all in Arrival.
Not in the movie. In the book, they do.
In Story of Your Life, they definitely do.
Well, speaking of Story of Your Life, I'm going to actually start my segment by talking about Ted Chiang, who wrote Story of Your Life.
Very excited for this.
Yeah, he's awesome. So he's based in Seattle, and he got a computer science degree from Brown University. But he had been submitting to sci-fi magazines since he was in high school. So in 1989, he sold his first story to Omni Press called The Tower of Babylon, and that story won him his first Nebula Award, which is one of the most important awards for sci-fi in America.
Yeah, no, that's awesome.
And since then, it's only kept going. He's a superstar in the world of science fiction short stories. It's one interview I read said it was from another author, and he was saying it's actually easier to name the awards that he hasn't won more than the awards that he's won, because he's won so many Nebula Awards, Hugo Awards, which are another big sci-fi award, and so many others.
Yeah.
And he's only published 15 short stories.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he's amazing. And there's another joke that I read, that the Hugo Awards only exist in case Ted Chiang writes a story that year.
That's so awesome.
And he's actually turned down a Hugo nomination for his short story, Liking What You See, a documentary in 2003, because he felt that the story wasn't good enough to be nominated because it didn't turn out like he thought, because an editor had rushed it.
You know you're good when you're refusing awards. You're like, no, please. No.
This could be better.
What it really was is that his shelf was getting too full.
Guys, I have to build another shelf. It won't be ready till next year.
Sorry.
But here's the thing. For all those awards that he's won, he's not as prominent as you actually think he would be. He actually has to support himself by working as a technical writer, explaining software to programmers at places like Microsoft.
That's really fun. You'd think someone who's so decorated would just be making heaps writing science fiction short stories.
Yeah, but he doesn't write, like, series.
Yeah.
He doesn't write anything that's, you know, going to sell to the... Everyone's going to buy it and they have to know what's going to happen next. He just writes very prestige short stories about science fiction.
Heaps aren't to be made in science fiction short stories, apparently.
Yeah. When he started writing sci-fi, it was considered a niche genre, and most people in the publishing industry didn't really take it seriously. So he actually started writing with the expectation that he would only reach a niche audience.
Yeah.
And he doesn't self-promote. He doesn't have Twitter. Often he releases his stories for free online. It's really about the writing.
Yeah.
But since this movie has gotten picked up and come out, three of his short stories have been optioned for possible adaptations. And it's still in the early stages, but I think this might be a turning point for him.
Based on the reviews of this movie, which I guess we'll get to at the end. But
yeah, it's done well. As far as Story of Your Life goes, the short story that this movie is based on, he spent 5 years researching linguistics before he felt prepared to write it.
And you can see that when you read the story.
Yeah.
It's so in-depth.
I actually, a lot of times I read to go to sleep. And when I was reading this book before bed, I was waking up because I had to think so hard about what I was reading. And unlike a lot of other sci-fi writers who want to get to the exciting parts of the story, the action, he's more interested in the explanations. He calls them beautiful explanations. And that's what I liked so much about Story of Your Life, were these lengthy, in-depth explanations that were beautiful.
Yeah, they were written really well. It's not like they weren't like reading a technical manual.
No, not at all. So good.
Yeah.
But this is going to take me to Eric Heiser, who you mentioned was a screenwriter for Arrival. And he's been a fervent fan of Ted Chiang's work for years. The first story he read was the short story Understand, and he read it online for free. And he loved it so much that day he bought the entire Ted Chiang's entire collection of short stories on Amazon.
Oh, wow.
And then he read it all in a day. And he said the Story of Your Life is the one that emotionally got him. And he had this feeling that he wanted to share that emotional effect with people. So he's in the movie business. He starts trying to pitch it to producers. And he says he would tell them, it's a female lead. It's a non-franchise movie. It deals with linguistic relativity. And that their eyes would just gloss over.
That's a big selling point.
Yeah. Know? All those things. That's exactly what movie producers want to hear.
They're like, when does Will Smith punch an alien in your movie? Is what they want to know.
I mean, it was what I was wondering throughout the entire movie. I'm just kidding. He estimates he got around 100 rejections. And they wanted him to change the hero to a man. They wanted him to take away the flashbacks. Like, all these things that are integral to the movie.
Yeah.
So he sat down with Dan Levine and Dan Cohen and their producers, and they had just read his script for a horror disaster movie called Ours. Paul Walker. He's the one from Fast and Furious, right?
Yeah, he died recently.
Yes, he was in it. And they loved the script, and they loved the idea of an emotional sci-fi. And he said they were the first in 2 years to call him back.
Wow.
So then the three of them spent years trying to pitch Story of Your Life to Hollywood studios, and none of them went for it. Same thing. So he finally volunteered to write a draft of the script on spec, which is a non-commissioned, unsolicited screenplay. And it's not something that an established film person would do. It's something that you would do hoping that your screenplay gets picked up.
Yeah.
But this is because he loved this story so much and he just couldn't get it out of his head. And after the script was written, all the studios passed again. But some financiers were passionate about it, and there actually ended up being a little bidding war. And finally, Lava Bear and Film Nation found out that they were both in the mix of the bidding war, so they bid together, and that way they would win, and they knew that they would make it happen.
Those are some cool names, Lava Bear.
Yeah, well, when you Lava get to Bear. Pick your name, you make it as cool as you can.
Dragon, Sexy Robots, and Adventures.
Best name ever. So now I'm going to take it to the director, Denis Villeneuve. He's French-Canadian, as we mentioned earlier. So I'm going to talk a little bit about his history with films. His first feature is August 32nd. I'm not exactly sure how to say it, and I couldn't find it online. So August 32nd, Earth, and it was made in 1998 about a woman whose worldview is altered by a car accident. And this is his first film, and it was Canada's foreign language submission to the Academy Awards. It didn't get nominated, but I feel like for a first film, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that is pretty good.
Then he made Maelstrom, about a woman undone by a series of misfortunes. And after that, he took a break to actually go and study cinema and screenwriting.
Which he hadn't studied prior to this,
nope,
I guess?
Nope, I guess not. And then he returned, and he vowed to only make movies that had a deep meaning for him. So just a few of his others, he made Polytechnique, about the 1989 massacre in Montreal of 14 young women by a gunman who was fighting feminism, which really happened. Yeah. And that won 9 Genie Awards, which is basically Canada's Oscars. Then he made Incendies, about a female Middle Eastern immigrant to Canada, and that was nominated for an Oscar, and that opened up Hollywood for him.
Yeah, I've read about that film. It's like lauded as a really great.
Yeah, he's obviously very talented. Yeah. So he met our producers, Dan Cohen and Dan Levine. Also, Sean Levy, who we talked about in our Stranger Things episode.
Oh,
so he eventually came on as a producer for this, too.
So many same names in these circles, you know.
Yeah, if you like sci-fi, you go for it.
Yeah.
And they asked Denis what he would like to do. And he said he wanted to do science fiction and that he'd actually been wanting to shoot science fiction for 30 years but hadn't quite found the right fit for him. So they gave him Story of Your Life, the actual story, not the script. And he read it and he knew it was exactly the kind of story he wanted to tell. But he was developing his next movie, Prisoners, at the time and didn't really have the time to adapt it. So he started working with Eric Heisser, who I talked about before. And I think it was over the course of a year, longer actually, that they wrote the script that you see now.
Okay.
And then, so after all the studios had passed on it earlier, the distribution rights were bought by Paramount for $20 million at the 2014 Cannes Film Festival. This is before the movie was even made. Amy Adams was set to star in it. Villeneuve was the director. And there was actually a huge bidding war for it. About 5 or 6 people wanted it.
Studios wanted it. What turned it? Like, what changed
it? I think it was Villeneuve. Paramount said it was the kind of film they wanted to do because they were missing that from their canon. But they'd also missed out on Sicario, which was the last film that Villeneuve had directed. And I think that was what was driving all of this because everyone wanted his next movie.
If you haven't seen Sicario, it's really good.
I know.
It's
meant to watch it,
intense.
And it just didn't happen. Yeah. I will watch it. I will watch it. Kyle said so many great things about it. So real fast, these are just some of the logistics. It has a budget. It had a budget of around $50 million. And to put that into perspective, because it sounds like so much money, that's 1/3 of what the latest Independence Day Resurgence cost.
Oh, my gosh.
It had its world... It had its world premiere at the Venice Film Festival on September 1st, 2016. It got screened at a number of other festivals, and the critics loved it. For a long time, it had a 100% Rotten Tomatoes score. Rotten Tomatoes is where they average out all of the critics' reviews. That score has since gone down to a 93. Still pretty good. Yeah, and it has a CineScore of a B, which is when they pull audience members after opening weekend and what did you think of the movie?
Yeah.
They gave it a B. It's made so far, this is right after opening weekend, it's made $24 million, which is really good, and it looks like it's going to recoup its cost. There's also hopes that it'll be in the Oscar race, especially with Amy Adams as the lead.
Yeah.
And they're banking on it doing well from that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a little bit about the...
nuts and bolts.
Behind the scenes, I should say. What did you think of the movie, Kyle?
I really, really liked the movie. I liked Denny's movie or previous movie, Sicario, a lot. And that's actually how I heard about this movie, was like through him. Like, I was like, oh, who's this director? And I found out he was doing a science fiction movie next with Amy Adams. And I was like, oh man, we got
to
do this.
You were the one who came to us and we're like, we have to do this one.
And then even on top of that, finding out that not only is it a science fiction movie by this director that I liked, but it's also a story that was in the Big Book of Sci-Fi, which we also did an episode
on. Story of Your Life is in the Big Book of Sci-Fi, which is just another reason to get it.
It's a compilation of science fiction stories by Anne and Jeff Vandermeer. I really liked it. I mean, it's definitely like a, not to sound haughty or, you know, snooty, it's a thinking person's science fiction movie.
You did sound haughty.
Jeff Goldblum is not blowing anything up in this movie.
Jeff Goldblum's not even in it.
He's not even in it. But I did really enjoy it. And just the cinematography and the shots, I think, were beautiful.
Oh, it is a beautiful, beautiful movie.
What'd you think, Claire?
Okay, so I think I did it wrong, but I read the book first, the short story, and then I saw the movie. And I hate being this person, but I couldn't get
the
book.
Let me guess.
Yeah. I couldn't get the book out of my head, and the movie is not as good as the book, just period.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get over it. And, you know, when things happen, you're like, oh, but it's not about that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of, I don't want to give a lot of way away, but there's a lot of conflict that is added to the movie that just isn't in the book.
Yeah. No, the book is like very Earth helping each other and stuff, and like everyone kind of working together. And it's not like a technical manual like what he writes, but it is very in depth.
Right. Whereas the movie, I understand them glossing over the technical stuff because that's hard. When you have it on the page, you can reread it and reread it until you get it.
Yeah.
Whereas in a movie, if you miss what they said once, it's over.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also, they took a lot of the science out of it.
They did.
And in the book, the science was so important. It was key to understanding these heptapods, these alien creatures. And Jeremy Renner. Yeah. I almost said Jeremy Piven. Jeremy Renner's character is just relegated to a sidekick. And in the book, he's so important. He's the physicist that works with Amy Adams' character, which is the linguist. And together, they're trying to understand
these aliens
these
and communicate
creatures.
With them. Yeah. Yeah. I did like, I mean, when you mentioned that when pitching this movie, everyone was like, you need to make the lead a man. I'm really glad they stuck to that because I feel like they easily could have swapped Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner's roles to try and just sell the script quickly. But the fact that they didn't, I think they get mad respect
for
that.
I feel like it is important that she be a woman at the end.
Yeah, I agree.
And I mean, Amy Adams is so good in this.
Yeah.
Jeremy Renner's good. He just doesn't have much to do. Yeah, Forest Whitaker's good. He just doesn't have much to do.
Jeremy Renner's the eye candy, all right? The heavy acting is done. The heavy lifting's done by Amy
Adams. Yeah, she's so good.
Yeah, I really like her. I mean, we mentioned that it was a beautiful movie and beautiful shots. I just want to, it's not too much of a spoiler, but there's this one shot where you're first seeing,
I think
like,
it's in the trailers,
alien.
Actually.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. Where you're first seeing the alien ship. And it's this sweeping, like, 7-second long take of this aerial shot in Montana. And there's just this mist pouring down a mountain and this big, black, scary ship just hovering there. And I read the book, or I read the short story after I saw the movie.
Right. I wish I'd done that.
One thing I wanted to mention, I brought it up on my segment, is the Sapir Whorf hypothesis. I feel like you really need to know what that is to enjoy the movie.
What
do you think?
I don't know, because I knew it going into the movie.
And you still didn't like it as much as the book?
No. Yeah. But I was more emotionally affected than I think I would have been if I didn't know it. And I was emotionally affected just throughout the movie because I knew what was going on.
Yeah, you knew what was going to happen. One thing I wanted to kind of address here is that it seems like there's more of these thinky sci-fi movies coming out recently.
Yeah.
Science fiction where it's not like an action adventure in space. It's more of like, it's a little more technical. Like movies like Interstellar, I feel like comes to mind.
I think that's kind of an action adventure in space.
Yeah, but there's no, they're not fighting off aliens.
No, that's true.
You know, there is a conflict there, but it's not, you know, Will Smith going, "Welcome to Earth," and punching an alien in the face. And in movies like Her also. Mm-hmm.
Definitely. Ex Machina.
Ex Machina, yeah. It's a little more theoretical, maybe philosophical, but definitely technical.
Right. And Hesser said in interviews that when he was pitching the movie, people were like, oh, audiences don't want thinking sci-fi.
Yeah, I kind of like it because they don't think the audience is dumb.
I appreciate that. And for all that I am not liking the movie, I did enjoy seeing it. And I'm so happy it's being made, and I really hope it does well, because I would like more of these kinds of movies to get made. This is the sci-fi that I really love.
Yeah. I think, like, and the message in it, you know, about, like, communication and things getting lost in translation and trying to figure each other out, I feel like it's very poignant right now, like, regardless of who you voted for in the election. Like, it does feel like there's a big divide in at least our country and in the States right
now. Yeah, because they put that in there and I was like, is that making a point about right now? Is that what you guys are doing?
But how long ago did they film this movie? It's like they knew.
Last year, I think.
Last year.
So, I mean, it was there then.
Yeah, it was there. I still thought in a way, I was like, oh, it's a little Nostradamus-y. So there's one quote in this movie that I think is pretty cool, and I think it pertains a lot to our podcast, especially about, you know, with language and the conquest of the Aztecs and, like, trying to get this film made. And Amy Adams' character has a quote. She says, "Language is the first weapon drawn in a conflict." And I don't know, for whatever reason, that stuck with me.
That's our hypothesis for this week.
Yeah, it's our theme.
Yeah. Mission We're introducing statement. Our hypothesis at the end, not at the beginning.
No. Doing it backwards. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's a cool movie, and I like that sci-fi is moving in this direction.
No, I completely agree.
Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com. And we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. We would love you like we would love a heptapod.
Which is a lot.
It's a lot. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's KLEX303.
I can be found at Along With Claire. That's CLAIRE.
And you can find our producer James at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, FOUHEYJR. You can learn more about Arrival on our Facebook page, where Claire and I will be posting some of our show notes. I'm going to post a really good talk by Boroditsky about Sapir Whorf.
Oh, and I'm going to post some of Ted Chiang's short stories.
Very cool, very cool. Our producer, who I feel would be carnally attracted to a heptapod should he ever see one, is James Fowey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland. And Patty, if you actually haven't seen this movie, you would be really into the language. Yeah, written language of it. It's very pretty. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who really only wishes that aliens would travel across space to deliver a superior chipwitch. Once again, this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures, A Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.